cases that change people's lives. The podcast series. You are very welcome to episode 5 in this series of cases that changed people's lives. The episode in the series opened up the sequence of events leading to the establishment of the right to legal representation and legal aid as part of a fair trial in Ireland at the time. There is a discussion of the circumstances in the courts prevailing prior to this legal aid, particularly with regard to young offenders, and how it came to pass that the courts required young offenders to be represented in court before being sent away to reformatories. The details are presented by leading Irish lawyer Erkus Stewart, Senior Counsel, who had been involved in constitutional challenges that brought about changes with far-reaching implications. I hope you enjoy it.
This case was important because it ensured to every person accused of a crime the right to a fair trial.
That was Senior Counsel Erkus Stewart talking about a case taken to the Supreme Court in the 1970s on the issue of free legal aid. That is, the right not just to a fair trial, but one paid out of the public purse in times when we cannot afford to have legal representation. Erkus took the case because of his experience as a young barrister defending children and young people in the Children's Court and the District Courts. Those courts were then very different to now. Let us not forget that journalist Nell McCafferty did much to highlight what went on at that time, and here she is reading from a column she wrote in November 1970 in the Irish Times.
In the Children's Court, in a 10-day period between November 17th and November 27th, 168 children were brought before Justice Kennedy. Of these, 75 were remanded pending further investigations by the Gardaí. Some cases were put back until after Christmas. Many have been awaiting sentence since October. In one case, when reproving two children, Justice Kennedy said, "I'll have no mercy on you. I'll send you to an industrial school. Do you know what I'm talking about?" In another, an 8-year-old boy denied telling the teacher that he took days off because he had to go out to buy whiskey for his father. Justice Kennedy said, "Are you a liar as well as everything else?" The father objected to such language to his son. Justice Kennedy said, "I'm not asking you, I'm asking him." The father said, "So that doesn't give me any say at all." Justice Kennedy said, "That doesn't give you any say at all." A boy was released on condition of a £100 independent surety. His parents produced, after several hours, a plumber's mate, a docker, and a fruit stall owner. They all came straight from work and possibly lost money doing so. In each case, they were refused on the grounds of having no property. This was not explained to the boy's mother. I finally took her aside and explained the situation myself, and she succeeded in finding a cafe owner. The mother of a 12-year-old convicted boy said, "What's he done that he gets 2 years in Dangan?" Justice Kennedy said, "I could send him until he is 16.
That was Nell McCafferty there. The case we're going to talk about in this programme this evening is the State Healy versus O'Donoghue. But before we get into the details of that case, Erkus Stewart began our conversation by describing how available legal aid was before that case came to court.
Well, when I started in 1970, legal aid was almost non-existent. Obviously, a person charged with murder would have the benefit of legal aid. And my very first case was in the Dublin Children's Court, which was then in Dublin Castle, a totally different building to what we now have. It is very grand at the moment. It was a very run-down building in the back of Dublin Castle. Children from 7 years of age up were constantly in that court, charged with sometimes serious, but more often very minor charges. They could end up being sent to places like Letterfrack Reformatory in County Galway, which is in the West Connemara, Dangan in County Offaly. The problem for the 7, 8, 9-year-old child that was sent there, the parents from the inner city, whether employed or unemployed, would never really be able to get to see them. a train journey to Galway now is expensive, so it, relatively speaking, it was expensive then. So when they got to Galway, they had to travel then to Letterfrack, 60 miles roughly, and public transport really was not available. So the children who were there probably never, at best, rarely saw their parents. And those children, in the main, in the children's court in Dublin and around the country, were tried and convicted without the benefit of anybody to assist them. It was a private court with no publicity, and in 99% of cases, except for the few well-to-do children who occasionally ended up there, they had no legal representation.
Were you personally involved in trying to raise the public profile of this at the time?
Yes, I was at the time, and it was through an inner city group around the Mayor Street, Sheriff Street area. And if you walk down there now, it is very grand, the Financial Services Centre. Just like if you go to Letterfrack today, it's a very beautiful setting. But then it was a completely different place. And so a few lawyers, I recall Brian Gallagher for one, Garrett Sheehan, we were involved in Paul Bosang. We were trying to assist to develop some way that the children could be represented in the children's courts, mainly in Dublin, but around the country if possible. And we did so on a constant basis then in the very early 70s.
When I invited you to look at a case for the purposes of this programme that had was a defining moment or changed people's lives, you, without a moment's hesitation, you mentioned this case of Healy. He was a very young man, wasn't he, who fell foul of the courts. Could you just give us a bit of historical context to the case?
They were two young boys, one 16 and one, I think, 17. They were inner city. They both had been in the children's court, but outside of Dublin, central city. It's mainly a district court building where they were. And they were each dealt with in the court without any solicitor or barrister. And they were sentenced, in the particular cases that we're now dealing with, to a total of 12 months in St. Patrick's Institution. And I only came across them, I suppose, by accident. They had already been sentenced, they were in custody, and with the assistance of a very willing solicitor, Brian Gallagher, we started an application for habeas corpus and an application to quash the convictions, because we argued that they had not been granted a fair trial, as they hadn't the benefit of a lawyer to represent them for what were serious charges.
Was this 1974?
Yes, 1974. Birth? They were, the two boys were in the children in the district court, and the cases finished in the High and Supreme Court in 75 and 76. They were not unlike hundreds, if not the vast majority, of young boys and girls in the courts who just did not have any lawyer with them, and there was nothing unusual in this.
I think the odd thing about it for us now is it's just beyond comprehension that anybody would actually be in that position. So it's very hard to reel back and find ourselves in a context where not only did they come up in the first instance, I think there were three appearances in court where they didn't have a solicitor, but then at a later stage, if I recollect correctly, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the latter part of 74, they came up again before another district justice. And whereas they had asked for legal representation at that stage, because a solicitor hadn't come on record or didn't appear, he went ahead and tried them anyway and found them guilty. And there were 2 6-month subsequent sentences.
Yes, and I think some of the Supreme Court judges who finally decided this matter did say that that particular district judge may well have been doing this in the interests of the young people, because they were now 7 weeks in custody, and he probably saw, well, look, this is better to deal with them and have them sentenced rather than delay. And he did sentence them then to 6 months plus 6 months consecutive.
Just give us an idea of how that case travelled through the courts. I mean, you were obviously involved in challenging it, and it went to the High Court, I think, first, didn't it?
We went first to the High Court where we challenged this, and we were successful to an extent, half an extent. We succeeded in quashing some of the charges, but others stood. So we had to then appeal to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court then was a court that was open to reviewing the state of the country now 30 to 40 years after the Constitution. And after argument, they could see there was a point, and they did develop the law in the case. And I think they pointed out, for example, both of these boys really were, one of the judges described them as having no particular educational attainments. Now, in fact, One of them was, I think, safe to say that he was illiterate. He could sign his name, but he couldn't write. He had memory defects, was an epileptic, and came from a very, very poor, unsettled background.
And so really the judges in the Supreme Court expanded the notion that not only there was a statutory right to have legal aid, to have legal representation, but that there was also incumbent on the judiciary a responsibility to advise the person and to ensure that they did. Wasn't that the significant difference?
That if a young person or even an adult was in court, they at least should be informed, you may have the right to be represented by a lawyer, you may have the right to legal aid, and if you wish to do so, you should apply. Up until then, there was no onus on anybody in the state or in any courts to inform people that they may well have a right to seek legal aid.
I think there's a very nice piece where the Chief Justice says,
before dealing with the submission on the grounds on which the conditional orders were made, I think I should say at the outset that it appears to me that the determination of the question of whether or not a court of local jurisdiction is acting within its jurisdiction is not confined to an examination of the statutory limits of jurisdiction imposed on the court. It appears to me that this question involves also an examination of whether or not the court is performing the basic function for which it is established, the administration of justice. Even if all the formalities of the statutory limitation of the court be complied with, and if the court procedures are formally satisfied, it is my opinion that the court in such instance is not acting within its jurisdiction, if at the same time the person accused is deprived of any of his basic rights of justice at a criminal trial.
They were pretty strong words, but it's, again, something we would take for granted now, isn't it? It's hard to believe that in the early 70s this had to be spelled out in that way.
Yes, those judges spelt it out and they have set down the standards. That was the then Chief Justice Tom O'Higgins. Another judge, Judge Henchy, who has been mentioned in previous programmes, stated,
a person who has been deprived of his liberty as a result of a prosecution which, because of his poverty, he has to bear without legal aid, has reason to complain that he has been meted out less than his constitutional due. This is particularly true if the absence of legal aid is compounded by factors such as a grave or complex charge, or ignorance or illiteracy, immaturity or other conditions rendering the accused incompetent to cope properly with the prosecution, or an inability, because of detentional restraint, to find or produce witnesses, or simply the fumbling incompetence that may occur when the accused is precipitated into the public glare and alien complexity of courtroom procedures, and is confronted with the might of a prosecution by the state. As the law stands, a legal aid certificate is the shield against such an unjust attack.
And they were very strong words of Judge Henchy. Mm. Judge Griffin, Judge Kenny made very, very strong judgments in the case.
And the context of this was in the initial stages that that these two actually pleaded guilty, so that they were going to be convicted on the basis of admissions which no one had advised them of the significance.
They pleaded guilty on their first appearance in court, and as all of the judges pointed out, a lawyer may well have advised them that they hadn't actually committed the offence and they should go to trial and plead not guilty and allow the state to prove the case, but they pleaded guilty without the benefit of any advice whatsoever. And they were clearly boys who did not have the understanding, as the judges have pointed out.
Mm. So really the two significant outturns of that was that, first of all, it was incumbent on the judge to advise and to ensure that the person did have legal representation if they wanted, and if they couldn't afford it, that the state would pay. And secondly, there was the other wing to it, that in circumstances where, if the solicitor didn't arrive, that the judge wouldn't proceed with the trial without the person being duly represented.
That's correct. Mm. That if it's clear that they did need a lawyer, that they should wait and put it back until there was a lawyer available to attend.
Argus, in view of the changes then, when this right was established, we have to consider what was the upshot of that?
It not only had an effect in the Children's Court all over Ireland, it affected trials in any district court in the country and trials in the higher courts. And obviously it changed the climate totally, that a person who was charged with a serious offence could at least seek the aid of a solicitor and or a barrister to defend him or himself or herself in the criminal charge. But on top of that, the person could well be guilty, but an articulate person, either a lawyer or somebody else, but in this case a lawyer, could at least make a plea or an argument in mitigation that do not send this child or this young person to jail or to letter frack. Give him a chance, perhaps use the probation and welfare service. So even those who were guilty, and clearly a good number of them must have been guilty, they would have at least had the benefit of somebody arguing their corner and putting forward some argument why In the particular instance, other redress, other approaches, probation, welfare, etc., should be used to see could you assist in reforming and rehabilitating the child much better than sending them to Letter Frack or Dangan. And there is no doubt that the Supreme Court judges were echoing what in fact was the reality in the courts around the country. They just did not have any means to defend themselves or to protect themselves.
How was it for you at the coalface of this in the early 70s? I mean, you would have been a young lawyer at that stage, building your career. How personally upsetting and difficult was a case like this?
I can recall being in Letter Frack Reformatory and seeing some of the children that I actually recognised from the court and speaking to boys who were only 7 years of age, and some of them that were there actually and would remain there for many, many years. And remember, the industrial schools and reformatories in the 70s were not only for criminal offences. Those who didn't attend school were sent there by the court. And some of them could remain there for some of them up till they were 16 years of age. It was the 70s, it was modern Ireland, but these courts, which were away from the public view, in the interest maybe of the child not to be exposed to the public glare and media, they were being tried and sentenced to long detention without anybody ever really knowing it. And nobody probably cared much because these were the poor of the inner cities.
I've heard you on a number of occasions talk about the Supreme Court at the time being a reflection of public opinion, or being in tandem with the standards that the public at that particular time would expect of the judiciary and of the constitutional rights. In your own recollection now, how much of a rising tide did you feel you were on at that time? Did you feel that there was empathy and that you had the support?
No, because you make your initial application in the High Court, and sometimes it is very difficult to get over the first hurdle. So I do recall in many of those cases in the early 70s, very difficult to actually get your case started, to get off the starting blocks. But once you got the opportunity in the High Court and later in the Supreme Court to air the case and to argue it out, I found the courts very, very welcoming and open to argument. The Supreme Court in the 60s and 70s developed the Constitution greatly. And I think in a way, it wasn't that they were usurping what the legislature was supposed to be doing. It's that the legislature had avoided the areas you have spoken about in your programmes on the other cases. And the legislature wasn't really functioning as it should have been. But the courts had to fill in the blanks and fill in the spaces. And they did huge work for this nation in 1960s and 1970s.
And isn't that sometimes called constitutionalising the law of tort, even, that we depended more and more on the Supreme Court to give us rights which hadn't been prescribed by statutory or other means? It's quite a controversial area. Do you think that's still happening?
Yes, but again, I think the courts would be quite happy to let government and legislature, as I think the former Judge Barrington stated, to allow the legislature to legislate for these matters.
I know it's a long time ago in some senses now. Have you a recollection of what the newspapers were doing? Well, what was the press coverage of this at the time? Was there support publicly?
Well, first of all, the press were not very, very common in the children's courts. And properly, they were not entitled to report the names of the young people going into the courts. I do recall one journalist who started in 1970, Neil McCafferty, took a huge interest and had a column in The Eyes of the Law, which brought publicity to this. Mm. She was reporting in the district court, and she did a lot of work in the children's court in the 70s. Mm. It did open it up, and I think there is no doubt that that did help in developing the rights of children at the time.
Mm. Going back specifically to this case then of Healy and Donoghue, was their convictions were quashed in the end? Did you win the case in the Supreme Court?
In the end, the Supreme Court quashed all of the convictions, and they left as free men.
And looking back on it, was there any moment in the Supreme Court when the judges were reading their judgments that you were in doubt, or did you think that you had persuaded them?
Yes, in those days the Supreme Court would deliver their judgments and you wouldn't know the result until the very, very end. Mm. In that case, it was a unanimous verdict of the five judges, and as the case developed, Chief Justice O'Higgins and the other judges gave their judgment. I did think we were winning.
I think we have an example of that we might just listen to.
Healy pleaded guilty, but was entitled to be heard and defended on sentence. He had no solicitor appearing for him, and in the circumstances was entitled to apply for legal aid. The district justice sentenced him without informing him of his right to apply for such aid. At this stage, in my opinion, justice required that Healy be informed of his rights, and if he so desired, be given legal aid. As this was not done, his conviction and sentence cannot stand. On the 30th of December 1974, Foran and Healy were granted certificates of legal aid under the Act of 1962, in respect of charges before District Justice O'Reilly. By reason of difficulties then existing in the operation of the scheme by solicitors, no solicitor appeared for them. On January 29, 1975, while unrepresented by a solicitor, each of these accused was sentenced to a term of detention in St. Patrick's Institution. In my view, the convictions and sentences then pronounced were in violation of the constitutional rights of both accused to have what justice required, i.e., a lawyer to speak for and defend them. For this reason, in my view, the convictions and sentences cannot stand.
In this particular case, there were felonies, weren't they? They had stolen cars, they had broken into St. Mary's Rugby Club, they had done some damage. They were relatively serious matters. There were going to be summarily dealt with. It wasn't
yes.
a judge and a jury. But
they were serious because they were breaking and entering. Now, the damage caused was, I think, £18, and the amount stolen was, I think, two bottles valued £6. So they weren't huge crimes, but they were serious because they were felonies, yes. And as you see, they were sentenced to 12 months. If they had gone to a jury and a circuit court, they could have been sentenced to much longer
yes.
sentences.
And back into the context of that time, were there other cases that come to mind where petty infringements with quite severe penalties could have been imposed on people who, because they didn't have representation?
Yes. Well, I can remember one very common offence, and maybe the Gardaí at the time saw a need to charge people with it. But at that time, there was an act, the Vagrancy Act of 1824. It's from a totally different era, but it was a very common charge for the guards in Dublin to charge young people with loitering with intent. And they really, the proofs for that was that this person had had convictions and he was hanging around and looked like he may do something wrong. Strangely, now that was, we did challenge that in the High Court and Supreme Court in a later case just 2 years later. The Supreme Court declared that part of the Vagrancy Act about loitering with intent unconstitutional. Oddly, other parts of the Vagrancy Act remained. Something similar is being introduced by the Minister now, and I'm not saying that the Minister of Justice is wrong, because there is a need to tackle problems in inner cities. That is his new proposals that were announced in the Dáil last week. But again, the District Court and Children's Court had charges against young people, which some of them were very, very spurious. And loitering with intent was really what you would do hanging around waiting for the cinema. You would not be charged. If you were somebody that you were known to the Gardaí, you would be charged. And it was really the word of the prosecuting Garda, how you were behaving, even though you committed no crime.
Mm. In the context of today, I suppose, and the way we take for granted so many of these rights, we have to cast our mind back to that early 70s period and look at it. And it was roller coaster. There seemed to be so many sweeping changes and defining cases, all based on people's constitutional rights. I mean, the Constitution was then seen as a living document rather than just something that was writ and kept in a drawer. But do you see any, you know, that expression, the tipping point, do you see any reason why at that time in the early 70s the timing was right, that the Supreme Court or that was it the public opinion that was right, or were they trying to reflect a changing society?
And I'm not, the courts do reflect, and they say they reflect public opinion, but to a great extent they are ahead of public opinion in cases like this, because the public at large in 1970 probably didn't see anything wrong with children being jailed. Because they were causing criminal damage or stealing, and therefore the vast majority of the public might not have objected. And there was no outcry about where the institutions were in Letterfrack and Dangan, etc. I think clearly one of your speakers, Donal Barrington, who was then a barrister, and barristers like him, Tommy Connolly, Rory O'Hanlon, they were active on behalf of their clients in defending their clients' rights, and they brought cases. And when those cases were aired in the courts, they were treated by a court that was open to these arguments, that Supreme Court in those days, and they developed the law.
Mm. Judge Barrington, you mentioned him there. He also mentioned that in his time of learning the law, that you always quoted the most recent House of Lords case, but that in the 70s, the significant difference was that there was reference to the American cases and to the American constitutional developments. Do you recall that being a persuasive influence at that time yourself?
Incredibly, and I now remember that in fact we referred to quite a number of US Supreme Court cases And the facts in the Supreme Court cases, one was called Gideon v. Wainwright, the facts in those were very, very similar to the Irish cases.
Really?
In which the Supreme Court in the United States had developed roughly similar rights. And yes, the Supreme Court at the time was very open to citing American judgments before the court. And I think they did. It did help develop the law here.
That's significant too when you think of the composition of the Supreme Court and how politically controversial that is in the United States, where the president's handpicking of certain members of the Supreme Court has become detrimental at times. In terms of the freedom of the appointment of the judiciary, is this something, and when you look back on that early period of the 70s, that you see as being something to cherish in our own setup here, the independence of the judiciary?
Yes, I think the public at that was well served by the judiciary, and they did develop in the interest. They really looked at what was this constitution that we had in 1937, what was it intended for, what was it intended to do, and they developed it and expanded it in accordance with what was clearly the intention, to have a just society and where people would have their rights vindicated through the courts, and in the instant case, the right to a fair trial, so that you would not be sent to prison or to a reformatory or to an industrial school without at least the benefit of a fair trial.
I suppose it's sort of a complexity to most people looking at the legal process when they say that one judge can turn something down and then that can be overturned by another group of judges. But in another sense, it's a stopgap and it's a safety net. Do you have any concerns about that in general? Or
yes, of course, if one judge in one court could actually take a totally different view to the judge in the court beside. That is the advantage, that at least when you go to the Supreme Court, in those days you had five judges, sometimes three judges, but in a constitutional case, five judges. And now the Supreme Court have, in the important constitutional cases, they sit with seven. And that definitely would give a better balance. And I think it is a good development that if I have a serious case as a citizen and the state is just as much entitled to a fair hearing in the Supreme Court, they will get a very good airing before seven different judges with a different coming from a different approach, and you will get, I think, a fair result at the end. Mm.
You must look back on this particular case that you were involved in with a certain degree of pride and a sense of achievement that you actually did and were involved in a case that was a defining moment in legal history and that established very significant rights for people.
It did, and I have to say that I only made the initial applications as a junior counsel. Rory O'Hanlon, now deceased, was senior counsel in the main part of this case and the main arguments. And a vital part of this whole case was Brian Gallagher, the solicitor, who was of huge assistance.
Mm. And in so many of these instances, that's what we're seeing, that people who were prepared to take it on and follow it through, we owe so much to them and to people like you. Thank you very much, Erica Stewart. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.